Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is film and television composer and music editor, Rich Walters. First of all, some good news. Music sales are up all over. Yes, in Germany, Italy, Sweden, the United States, and Canada, sales have been up for the first half of 2015. In some cases, they've been up by little. In some cases, they've been up by a lot. But just the fact of the matter is that sales have increased really means a lot because it's telling us that more and more people are buying. Now, what are they buying? Well, they're not buying CDs. CD sales are down. They continue to go down, although not as quickly as everyone had predicted. So they're going to be around for a while, and they're going to be a force, but they still decrease every month. That being said, digital music is increasing, and more of the revenue that the music industry receives comes from digital music, and more of that comes from streaming. Now, one of the interesting byproducts of streaming, and actually digital music in general, is the fact that we're now in a singles mentality. In other words, we listen to single songs, we don't listen to albums. And one of the things that Nielsen also tracks is something known as overall album consumption, or OAC. And what that means is how many people are actually listening to albums that we can track. Well, it turns out that almost everywhere, this figure is going down except for one place, the United States. Yes, in the U.S., we are still listening to albums, and in fact, that was up 14% last year. Why? Well, nobody seems to know. Nobody even has a good theory on why that happened. And the general feeling is by the end of the year, that will flatten out a bit. But even so, just the fact that people are listening to albums again, it's kind of a good thing. In other news, SoundCloud has announced that it's going to have a subscription tier. Up until now, it was free to listen to SoundCloud, and there were no limits. But that's going to change pretty soon. There's going to be two tiers. It'll be freemium, just like every other streaming service out there. And the free service, in fact, will be capped, so there'll be a limited number of listens that you'll have. We don't know what that figure is yet. And you'll have an unlimited number when you pay for it. And again, we don't know how much that's going to be either, but the assumption is going to be around $10. This is probably not going to affect the pro users out there, and that means the content creators, the songwriters, the bands, the artists, because you're already paying $6 to $15 a month just for more storage and more capability. So this won't really affect you, but the listeners will be affected on one level or another. Now, this is being prompted by investor pressure and by label pressure. Investors want to make money from their investment, and the major labels want to make money as well, which they're not making right now from SoundCloud. So this is all going to change pretty soon. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. Also, take your career to the next level with my Music Prosperity Breakthrough program at musicprosperitybreakthrough.com. Now on to music news. First of all, Rode Microphones bought Aphex this week. For many of you, this doesn't mean anything, but for many of the old-timers, we remember the original Aphex. Now, the original Aphex systems came about in 1975 when they released their Aural Exciter, and that was a big deal. We take it for granted these days, but that was a big deal because it was the first type of Aural Exciter that was out there. And what is an Aural Exciter? Well, it's a dynamic EQ basically for high end, but it also adds in some pleasing harmonics that we kind of like. So it's not exactly like raising the high end EQ, but it does sort of the same thing. It brightens things up and it makes it sparkle and tinkle. And this was a really big deal in 1975. So you couldn't buy the unit, the original Aphex Aural Exciter. What you do is you'd rent it. You'd rent it for $30 a minute, and this was a finished minute. So basically, if your song was 3 minutes, then you'd pay $90. But really, $30 in 1975 dollars is about $130 today. So it would cost you the equivalent of $500 or $600 per song to use on your record. Some people even took it out on the road with them. And of course, this is bigger artists that could afford it. But this was a big deal at one time. The Aural Exciter basically had the audio world at their feet for 2 or 3 years anyway. Like with most processors, they really sound great. And when they first hit the public consciousness, everybody uses them and they use them to death. And then you kind of get over it and you go, maybe I liked it better before. So that's kind of what happened with the Aural Exciter. Aphex then came out with a unit that you could purchase from them. They had a pro unit, and then they had what they called Type B, and then again Type C, which were even cheaper still. Aphex eventually then licensed their technology to other companies. Yamaha is the one that comes to mind. And then there were other companies that kind of got into the Aural Exciter business. Like, for instance, Joe Meek and Behringer and SPL, and they came out with their own version of the Aural Exciter. And again, it's one of those things where you rarely see in studios, in pro studios especially. The last 10 years, I don't remember seeing them at all. That being said, Aphex was a really good company that made a lot of great gear. And the one in particular, one piece, was their Compeller limiter, which was really marvelous. It was so good that a lot of radio stations have used it in their broadcast chain because it was very, very effective. I also knew a lot of producers and engineers that would use it as well during tracking because it was one of those things where you set a brick wall and it would stay there. And the reason why, when you asked it to stay at a certain level, it just stayed there. This was no big deal in our modern digital world because we have what's known as brick wall limiters, but way back when, in the analog days, this was a big deal and the Compeller was the best of the bunch. So Rode Microphones, another very, very good company, just bought Aphex, and I think it'll be a good fit. Marvin Caesar, the longtime owner of Aphex, sold the company 2 or 3 years ago, and really it hasn't done well since. So it's good to know that Aphex is going to be in good hands. In other music news, Guitar Center is back in the news, and they're being sued by the National Labor Relations Board for something that we talked about a lot here, and basically what it is, they're being accused of discriminating against their union employees. And the way they did that, or the way they're accused of doing that, is by lowering commissions and lowering their wages. So the accusation goes that if you were in the union, you'd make less money as a result, which is against the law. So the National Labor Relations Board has gotten into the act in the city of Chicago and has sued Guitar Center, so it should be interesting to see how that shakes out. My guest today is Rich Walters, who's a noted film and television composer. He's been nominated for 2 Emmys and 2 Canadian Screen Awards. Rich's recent credits include the Sci-Fi Channel show Olympus, the feature film Chappie, as well as a ton of movies of the week for various cable channels. I spoke with him via Skype from his studio in Vancouver. So you were a drummer first, right?
Mainly, yeah. Yeah, that's where I started playing clarinet in like high school in the school band in grade 6. And while I was sitting there playing the licorice stick, I used to look behind me at the percussion section and go, you know, I want to hit those things. That's what I want to do, you know? So I ended up back there sooner or later, yeah.
So did you start playing with bands and everything as a drummer?
Yeah. I started, you know, I just went, you know, the school system here in Canada, and I'm sure in the U.S., all over North America for that, you know, it really nurtures if you show an interest. And I ended up where I grew up, I ended up getting lucky and having really great music teachers throughout my whole like tutelage through school and that just nurtured all that interest that I had. So within being in the percussion section, you know, timpani, xylophone, glock, like all the stuff, you know, And then I went into I really got into jazz as well, jazz drumming as well. And the high school I played in years later had a really competitive jazz band. We used to tour in the U.S. and play big festivals, jazz festivals down there all the time. And we, you know, we won a lot and did a lot of traveling. It was great. So and being a jazz drummer as well, you know, taught me to start like. Reading the first horn charts and stuff like that to, you know, to set up the band and, you know, do the, to see what, you know, to start interpreting and move beyond just like hitting things and understanding, you know, melody and stuff like that as well. So it was great in that respect.
Gee, I never heard that before, but it makes a lot of sense. We're, you know, to read the horn charts to understand where to go.
Anytime we started a piece, I'd always grab the first horn charts and see what they were doing, see where I could accentuate hitting there, coming in with the shots and stabs and stuff like that, just so I'd have just a bit more insight into the parts, right?
Yeah.
And it always worked well. You know, you could go in and sight read something, because in all those jazz festivals, you know, they'll have like a facet of it was like sight reading competition. And I remember that used to be where that was really helpful, right? You know, yeah. Where you're just going through it the first time, and we get the adjudication tapes back later. And I remember one adjudicator, and it always stuck with me. On a tape, he's very quiet. He's like, okay, you guys are doing very well. He stopped. He goes, your drummer's a monster. And then he goes, and then he just, so that was fun. That was good hearing that. Yeah.
Did you, so then it seemed like a short step to become a professional musician from there for you, right?
It was in my DNA. I knew as soon as I left high school that I'd probably have a sad life if I didn't do something involved in music. So, you know, I went to Europe for a while after high school. I went there initially with the high school orchestra, and then I stayed there and toured with a friend for a while longer, came back and just decided that I need to go to music school. So I came to a university here in Vancouver. I took a couple years at university, and I only finished a couple years, and then, you know, rock and roll and electronica called, and I went out and just played in bands for all manner of, you know, genres and that for, probably 8 years or so, and then I fell into the film thing, you know, and then that was it. I remember just going, okay, I want to get into composition. That's the gig I want.
So how did that happen? Because so many people want to get into it, and so few can. How did it happen for you?
Well, it was such a, you know, it's funny. Like, I never had any intent. So I was playing in bands, working a part-time job in a warehouse in a Greyhound bus lines shipping warehouse, part-time, gigging the other part-time. And I got a job in a post-production sound facility, a place here in Vancouver called Sharp Sound, as a dialogue and ADR WALA programmer. I used to make the sheets for the dialogue in the WALA sessions. And you know, when I first got this job, it paid great. So it was like, wow. And I worked my own hours. I worked for myself. It was a really, lucrative, great gig that I could do whenever I wanted, more or less. I had no boss. I just got contracts. But what this job, it was kind of a nothing job. But what this job did do is, because of the nature of it, I was in direct contact with every show they had. I had to talk directly to every post-production supervisor or coordinator in town. So I got to develop relationships with all these key people on shows. I started doing music editing. And then, so when I crossed into music editing, it was really easy for me, because all of a sudden I had a direct line to all these people I already had a relationship with. And they knew me because of my, my desire to always, you know, I was dependable, all that stuff. So the phone started ringing on the music editing front. And then I just transitioned into composition. And that was tough as well, because people want to put you in a box, right? And I was known as Rich the music editor for so long, and to try and bust that mold, it took some time. It really did.
Can you describe music editing, what your job is? Because a lot of people that listen to this podcast in particular don't quite understand that. When they think of music editing, they think sitting down at your DAW and editing music, but that's not the job.
Oh no, it's you know, your music editors are really the unsung heroes of it all. I mean, they're such a key component, and that's really interesting, your reaction, because, and I see it all the time when I meet people, it's not a known position, but like I say, they're so integral, because you're responsible for like wrangling all the music, making sure the producers are happy, the composer's happy. It's a highly political position, in the fact that you're always usually placed sometimes in the middle of a dangerous situation where the composer's doesn't like the producers anymore and the producers don't like the composer, but you got to be the middle guy keeping the peace between everybody. So your responsibilities are cutting all the source music, preparing quick times for review, taking notes, spotting sessions, just, you know, the organization of it all, or doing retracking of already written cues to new picture to help alleviate the composer's workflow and such. It's such a vast job. And you can be either a music editor that's hired by the production that goes and sits on the dub stage during a mix, or you can be a composer's music editor, essentially. So there's different kinds of music editors. You can be a music editor that just cuts temp music. So when a show is, when a movie's finished shooting, they'll hire a music editor just to come in and sit at the editorial office and just cut temp music as they start assembling the footage, just so that the producers and editors and that can start to get a feel of how the show's coming together and how it looks with music. So there's all these different subgenres and you know, weird vocations that you can do as a music editor.
How does that work if you're going to cut temp music, then you're brought in just to do that? Are you using your tastes on that, what you think would fit? Or are you given guidelines by the producer, director?
It's a bit of everything. Sometimes in some instances I would have showed up to a place and they're just like, I don't know, you know, just see what works. And you just go through, you know, you just go, like, I buy every soundtrack that comes out and just, like, you know, give it a once through, catalog it that. And sometimes you come in as they're already deep in the edit and the editor's already putting stuff against picture, but because of the nature of Avid or whatever, it's just not as malleable as Pro Tools. And because you have a higher skill setting as an editor and cutting music and understanding it, and you know, you can use reverb tricks and all kinds of stuff to make endings and that. So sometimes you're brought in, they have a very definitive direction, and you're just in there, you know, just cleaning stuff up and tempo mapping, beat matching stuff and that. But again, it's different all the time. It really depends, you know.
When you first started doing composition then, were you doing it mostly for television or were you doing film right from the beginning?
It was mainly TV, MOWs, like movies of the week. Yeah, that was my first paying gig, was an MOW, yeah. And then before that, it was always just short films, just like meeting new directors and just doing whatever you can to start working on the skill set.
How did you make the jump from television to feature films?
Honestly, I think just by constantly doing it. There wasn't any like definitive moment where it was like, all right, I've arrived, you know. And I don't think there ever will be. It's you know, because for a bit of backstory too. So I'm speaking to you from Vancouver, and I work in LA a lot, in London and such, and an advantage. Well, what I see is geographically, each of these markets are very different, especially for someone in my position, because in the city of Vancouver, I can still be both. I can still run a music editing enterprise and a composition enterprise. In Los Angeles, I can't do that. I'm either Rich the music editor or Rich the composer. Yeah. And it's to backtrack what I said before about people want to put you in a box. They don't want, you know, so. And then in London, I'm usually, yeah, it's the same thing again there. Vancouver's more malleable. The it's a smaller market here. So yeah, in terms of a jumping off point or a watershed moment there, they're really, you know, I just finished writing a TV series called Olympus, and yeah. next week I'm on a dub stage helping a composer friend of mine in LA. I'm sitting in as the music editor on the dub stage to babysit his mix. So it's, you know, and during that TV series, I was, you know, it was a very high profile thing. We had live strings. I got to do live orchestra through it and everything. So, you know, you go from there, and then you know, it's all over the map. It's kind of crazy.
What's the difference between writing for television and writing for a feature?
You know, for me, I don't really think there is a big difference. And I'm only speaking like for myself, because I like to approach television stuff in a filmic sense, like in a in a bigger scale. Like I don't want to dummy it down for TV. And I guess I've been lucky with the TV stuff that it's the projects I've done have welcomed that kind of say bigger writing or more open stuff, I guess. Yeah, I really, you know, the main difference I would say, and not on a, is just the timelines, like the dead, you know, on a TV series when I just, the last one I just finished, I was having to do a mix a week, get ready for a mix a week. So you're doing like 25 to 33 minutes of music a week, plus orchestrating, recording, mixing. Like, you know, for me, that's a 5-month schedule, and that's 7 days a week, minimum 14 hours a day. Like that's, and for film, you know, before Olympus, I just finished Chappie with Neil Blomkamp, and I worked with Zimmer on that. And it's, you know, it's definitely this, the timeline is broader. So, but that being said, you're still going every day. It's just, you don't have that weekly deadline that, you know, it really tightens up at the end when you're doing a film.
Do you do your own orchestration and conducting?
No, I hire. I have this a brilliant friend of mine in Vancouver here. His name's Alain Meran. He's he's brilliant. He's way better at it than I would ever be. And you're only as good as the people you surround yourself with. So, you know, and again, with television, I just don't have the time, you know. It's a team thing. Yeah, it works great to have him helping me out with that.
Do you often do scores where you don't have the budget to be able to go out and hire a full orchestra and you just do it yourself?
Yeah, that's 9 times out of 10 that happens, really? Right? That's why, like with Olympus, it was a great thing when they came up to me afterwards and said, "Hey, we have a contingency for you. Here's some money. Go do live musicians with this." But 9 times out of 10 in where I'm situated now in my career, it's in the box. It's all in the box, you know. What? And that can, you know, you can rip that pretty good. You can make a great go of it. It takes time. It takes a lot of time to finesse the MIDIs and to layer stuff. And to, you know, you got to know your libraries and that. So again, time. Yeah.
Boy, it must be especially hard when you're coming from the background that you came from, you know, more in a jazz setting where you don't think orchestrally so much, you know,
yeah.
Or you play in a rock band where you don't think you think orchestrally, but not for an orchestra, you know, your arrangements are smaller.
You know, I tell you, Bobby, what really helped me out. And again, you know, was all the time I spent playing in orchestras in the percussion session in my youth, you know, again, reading the charts, I paid attention to the charts of the other players at that time as well, and I find myself, you know, going back to those places and just regleaning all that knowledge that I learned like way back then that's still in there, you know. And yeah. and again, my the guy I work with, Elaine, he teaches me so much as well. It's incredible. Yeah.
You mentioned Hans Zimmer. Did you work with him previously, or was this just the first thing that you worked with him
on? That was the first time I was invited down to his studio, and he literally called me one day out of the blue. I was on a dub stage here in Vancouver. He called me up and I just answered my phone and it was him. And he said, come down to my studio. I want you to help me finish Chappie, because I was already working on Chappie with Neil. And Neil had a conversation with him about myself, and he thought it would be a great idea to get me down there. And so it was great. I literally, you know, packed it all up and then showed up and was, just completely immersed into his situation right away. It was like going from 0 to 100 in a matter of a few days. So,
well, what was that like, first of all, from a collaboration standpoint? Because I guess it's not like film scores collaborate all that often, right?
You
usually do it.
It was amazing because, you know, standing on the outside looking in for all these years at Hans Zimmer and wondering, you know, like, how does it work for him? Immediately, I was completely floored at, like, Hans's ability. Like, he in my opinion, Hans is, like, the ultimate collaborator. Like, it's incredible. And when I left there, when I left his studio, that was one of the biggest things that, you know, in my post-mortem notes that I have up here, that I was just reminded the power of collaboration in a project like the size of a major motion picture like that. Like, so many things would come up, and we would have part of their workflow down there is they'll have these think tank meeting sessions where we all go sit in Hans's room, and literally we're in there 6 to 8 hours and just, you know, just throwing out ideas, watching YouTube videos, just talking, fleshing stuff out. And so much comes from that. So many ideas just manifest in that scenario that wouldn't if we were all left to our own devices, right? But being brought in as a group, it was just one of those light switch moments again where it was like, yeah, I need to collaborate more in the future, I think, because this works.
Is that the way he works in all of his films then?
I'm not sure all of them. I imagine he does quite a bit. From what I see, what I gleaned, I think it's a very regular thing for him. But I can't say for sure, you know. But in Chappie, yes, definitely, yeah.
But it sounds so unique to do that. I have a lot of composer friends, and I don't remember any of them ever telling me that, you know, they collaborated much when they're doing something. It's very solitary, as a matter of fact.
It is. It's such a solitary job, right? Position, vocation. Yeah, you spend so much time alone. Yeah, yeah. And being in a group situation was, you know, you still break and go to your edit suites and that, but, you know, you're still coming out and going for lunch with guys and talking about the show and trading cues and plug in presets and stuff like that, right? Like,
yeah,
it's geek mania and it's fun, right?
Well, that's one of the things that a lot of us kind of miss about the old days, the old studio days here in LA, where you'd be in a facility that had three or four studios, and there'd be not the collaboration, but the camaraderie you'd have with the other people that were working. You know, you'd run into people in the hallway, you'd run into them in the lounge, and, you know, you just sit and chat for a while and exchange ideas. And if nothing else, it was fun to be able to talk to somebody else for a change, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, that's funny you say that, because right now I'm at the bottom of the bell curve again here in my work schedule, and I'm by myself in my big studio here. When I'm busy, I have at least a couple guys, two other guys here with me, and it's not until like they start showing up again, and I tell them, I go, oh, it's great having you guys around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm the same way. Some days I have to force myself to go out and have lunch with someone, even though I don't have the time, but it's like, okay, I just need some human contact for a change, you know, just for a little bit.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I get it. So, Rich, what are the struggles that the modern day or the current day composer has? I mean, it's a different mindset than it used to be, right?
Yeah, I think for me, the struggles are timelines. You know, it's pretty time, money, the budgets. You're always fighting for more money. You're always fighting for more time, and you always want to get a great show. It's those, for me, it's those three things. You know, I'm lucky. I have an agent in LA who gets to kind of be the bad cop, and I can just be the good cop. But you know, that's it. You just want to work on interesting things. But unfortunately, it can't always be that way. You know, there's a lot of not interesting things that get produced and that need help from guys like us. So it's just, you know, we got to make a living here. And that's another thing about being in the Vancouver market is it's certainly tougher up here for a guy in my position, because we hit a glass ceiling here where a Vancouver composer who's living in Vancouver would never get a American TV series or a studio picture per se. That they would never consider anybody from Vancouver. You would have to be, you have to be in Los Angeles to be, or in a big center in the U.S. to be, you know, kind of even looked at twice for that. So that's difficult being in Vancouver. We're kind of pigeonholed up here in that respect.
Well, how did that happen for you, Rich?
In what do you mean?
Well, in terms of you know, you're working on Hollywood.
Well, that's all the time. That's interesting because for me, that's a direct result of my relationship I have with Neil Blomkamp, right? And Neil is somewhat of an anomaly up here because he's a guy that does studio pictures, but because he lives in Vancouver and his family's here, his wife and his daughter, he wants to finish his films here. He brings editorial up here. He wants to finish the sound here. There's no one else like him in this city that's doing that caliber of film at that say budget level or so Neil is a complete beast of his own, you know, a complete anomaly in that respect. There's and that being said, is that just doesn't exist then, right?
Yeah.
He's the only one. So I guess I was lucky enough to have a relationship with him way back when Elysium. But it's funny because I first was introduced to Neil when he was doing Elysium. And I was in L.A. looking for work, and I got a call from my agent and said, hey, this show in Vancouver needs a Canadian music editor, and your name's come up. Do you want to go back to Vancouver? And I was like, damn it. Every time I get down here, Vancouver calls.
Meant to be. So,
yeah, I guess. So, you know, I dug a little deeper. It was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I'll go back up for that. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Let's get geeky for a second.
Okay.
So, what's your workflow? What do you usually work on in terms of what's your DAW, what's your process? How, you know, let's just say you're doing something that's in the box. What are you working on?
Always Logic, always writing in Logic. Everything's delivered in Pro Tools. I use Kontakt is the main sampler, sampler. All the Kontakt, you know, just everything that everybody else is using, essentially, you know. I like a lot of outboard gears, Moog synths, you know, the Sub 37, the Voyager, that kind of stuff. I like to get out of the box when I can, depending on the project, right?
Yeah.
And I'm a big advocate of, like, if I do have to do most of it in the box, I always like to at least throw up the mics and record something live on it. Yeah. Just put at least something. Even if it's just like a dulcimer, plucking a dulcimer away in the background or something. Because I really believe it adds just a when you do that, when you go through that process and record something with a mic and through some, like, some nice channel strips and a proper mic and that, you know, that it really elevates any cue that you're writing. It just adds another element to it, an element of realism and excitement and legitimacy. That's what I find. So I try really hard to always do that, to record something live.
You mentioned before about Logic. Oh, why do you use Logic? Is it because of the MIDI involved?
Yeah. Essentially, yeah. Logic's MIDI functions. But, you know, I got into Logic... I remember years ago, back in 2000 and I think it was 2005, I got to work with Michael Dana on a film that mixed up here in Vancouver called Capote. It was one that Philip Seymour Hoffman, he won an Oscar for it that year.
Yeah.
And when I met Michael, when he came up for the mix and all that, you know, talking tech and that, I was still trying to make a go of it in Pro Tools as my DAW as well, like as my writing platform. And he started, you know, we talked about Logic and that. And it was at that point that I went, okay, forget it. And you know, kind of my reluctance too was like climbing the learning curve. It's like, I was just like, okay, here we go. Here's the 2-year kind of like, zzz, you know, here we go. Let's this. But so that was, I remember that was the real, that was the moment where I just said, okay, it's going to be Logic. And I hadn't looked back since. And then, you know, in hindsight now, I look at Cubase and I go, oh, geez, maybe I should have. Geez, I kind of wish I would have done that one, you know. But I guess its grass is always greener on the other side.
Yeah, Cubase is making a lot of strides, especially the latest version. Yeah.
Yeah, I see my orchestrator uses Cubase, and down at Remote Control, all of Hans's rooms have Cubase, and yeah, it was I was almost thinking of blowing up Logic this year and saying, okay, we're going to move to Cubase, you know.
I was a Nuendo user for a long time and finally gave up on it and moved to Pro Tools because it was just too painful going back and forth all the time. It's like, yeah. Okay, well, I'll just give in, bite the bullet.
Yeah. Now, in respect to music editing, I only do that in Pro Tools. I don't do any of that in Logic. It, you know, Pro Tools with the algorithms and that is built way better with the crossfading and that. It's way better for music editing.
Yeah. Where do you see film music going? Is there a trend?
I was talking about this with a friend the other day, and it was more on the technological front. Like, I see when I got in the game to where we are now and how all the non-linear editing and that, it's accelerated the timelines. It's accelerated the flexibility of everything. Like, when we're on a dub stage now, even on the picture end of stuff, we're still working to unlocked picture. And we spend so much of our time just conforming because they're always updating picture. I remember when I got into this game, there was no such thing as, you never did anything to unlocked picture. And then years later, this term soft lock came into play. Yeah. And everyone was like, soft lock? What is that? We can't have soft lock. We can't work on this. It's not locked. So I think where is it going technically? I can't imagine where it's going to end up. In 10 years, I have no idea. Like, am I going to be doing, can well be able to do this job on my smartphone? I don't know, you know?
But musically though, where's it going, do you think? Is there a trend?
I don't know, Bobby. I really don't think so. I think it's just going to be up to the innovators, you know? There's so many guys do so many different, like, tones and timbres and idioms and, you know, like, I don't know. When you listen to it stylistically, it certainly has become, it seems, well, again, it depends on the genre of the film. If we're talking about animation, it's, you know, it's still very melodic, very on the nose kind of stuff. But if you're looking at, like, big sci-fi scores or whatever, they tend to be, you know, longer, more open kind of sounding scores. So, yeah, who knows? Maybe the other shoe will drop and it'll go back to, you know, more Korn Goldie, and I don't know. I'm just going to sit along and see what I can manifest in the meantime.
I hear your phone blowing up here, so one last question. Yeah. I'll let you get back to it. What's the best piece of business advice that you either learned through your time in the business or someone imparted to you?
You know what my best piece of business advice is, and it's one of my mantras. It's just be cool. That's it. Don't overreact when you're asked to do something. Just smile. Be professional all the time. Don't let them see you sweat. Be grateful and just do it. You know, a friend of mine told me something a few years ago, and it stuck with me ever since. He's a guy named Lee Smith. He's Christopher Nolan's editor. He cut all the Batman movies, and I was working. He worked with us on Elysium and Chappie. And I remember when he came aboard Elysium and when we became friends and that, sitting around the lunch table and all this stuff. He said something one day, and it stuck with me since. And he said, you know, he says, when we take a job, he says, at that point, he says, we have given up the right to bitch about it, because we had a choice not to take this. So we took it. So we just got to dig in and do it. And that, you know, that kind of mentality is where my head is at, you know. Just be cool. You're going to get asked to do some dumb, stupid things by people, things that you don't agree with at all. But you know what? They're your clients. You're doing their film. It's not your film. And you got to keep that in mind and just grin and bear it and just do what your clients want. And I think then you'll have success. You know,
that's great advice, Rich. Very cool. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you so much for doing this. This has been great. To find out more about Rich, go to richwaltersmusic.com. It's all one word, richwaltersmusic.com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many, many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com, and he helps put the show together. Thank you kindly, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I'll see you next time.